Impulsively, Edith took May's hand. May, I promised Sarah that if anything happened to her, I would make sure Stephen ended up with good people. I swore he would never live with her husband's family. She said they were fiends. Then Stephen will be raised by her husband's family over my dead body, said May. She stated it like a simple fact, and Edith thought that it was the very absence of malice in her voice that made her fearsome. Over mine, too, said Edith. But I might have to leave before we know if Sarah will get well. As soon as I get word from back home that it's safe, I'll need to go back. If I stay away too long, people will begin to wonder about me. Wherever you are, Thomas and I will make sure you keep your promise to Sarah. You have my word on that. Edith smiled. You remind me of my friend John, who brought Sarah and Stephen to me. The way you keep so calm and certain, as if there's a peaceful river running through you. May smiled back. Oh, but really it's fierce and wild. It's all I can do to keep it in check. I'll bet John's river is that way, too. The next morning, when Edith came downstairs, May told her that Thomas was bringing Sarah and Stephen home. Oh, but that's wonderful, said Edith, confused by May's grave expression. No, said May. She's still very, very sick. Thomas said she had no business being anywhere but a hospital. Why then? One of the student nurses who doesn't know about what we do accidentally entered Sarah's room with a tray of food, despite the quarantine sign. Thomas and another nurse, one of ours, were in there with Sarah. They had forgotten to lock the door, you see. It's hard to do everything right when you're exhausted, and that quarantine sign should have been enough, but it wasn't. Oh, no, said Edith. It may well be nothing. Thomas said the student nurse just blushed and stammered an apology and left. But even so, he thought it best to bring Sarah home. Later that morning, Thomas carried her into the house in his arms, stepping gingerly, jarring her as little as possible. But Sarah's face was gray with pain, and she winced with every step. Still, Edith believed she looked a little bit better than she'd looked during the drive to Canada, more lucid. When her eyes met Edith's, she moved her mouth, and although no sound came out, Edith knew Sarah was saying thank you. Thomas took Sarah into the downstairs bedroom just off the living room, a room more like a closet, windowless, and too small to contain more than a bed and a leather armchair. May had made up the bed and set a crib for Stephen in her own bedroom. Thomas would spend nights in the armchair, keeping watch. After Sarah fell asleep, Thomas came into the kitchen, sat down at the table, and his mother brought him a plate of food. In the daylight, his face was drawn, exhausted, but still remarkably boyish. Edith thought that if he was out of his 20s, it wasn't by much. But when he spoke, he sounded like an old man. I wish to God I hadn't had to bring her here. I wish to God. 2 days passed without any word from John. I'm sure a letter is on the way, said May. Don't worry. I won't, said Edith. Even so, that night, Edith did worry, and the worry sent her mind darting like a dragonfly, unable to settle. Because sleep was impossible, she drew on the robe May had lent her and went down the back stairs in the dark, her feet feeling their way on the worn silken wood, her hand holding firmly to the banister. When she got to the kitchen, she gasped at the transformation night had wrought on the cozy room. Moonlight spilled like mercury through the black branches of the maple tree outside the window, figuring crazy shadows on the walls and on the strawberry print tablecloth, shadows that writhed and rippled as the wind blew. The linoleum gleamed like steel and burned the soles of her bare feet with cold. Edith felt heavy and dark in the middle of the mutable, quicksilvered room, like a rock on the bed of a flowing stream, and, as she stood there, she was filled with the presentiment that something was about to happen, something frightening, that she was about to be tumbled loose by a current and carried away. You're ridiculous, she scolded herself. You're safe here in this house. And, as noiselessly as she could, so as not to wake Thomas or Sarah or the baby, she began to open cupboards, searching for a water glass. But before she found one, she heard, from outside the kitchen windows, what she instinctively recognized as the crunch of footsteps on frozen grass, and panic gripped her. They found us, she thought bleakly. We're caught. All that driving was for nothing. Oh, poor Sarah, poor Stephen, poor little baby. The silhouette of a man in a hat materialized at the kitchen door, and then he was turning a key in the lock, and then he was pushing the door open, and then he was standing in the kitchen staring at her and saying, Jesus Christ, you nearly scared me to death. George. Oh, George, she whispered, pressing her hand to her heart. Thank God it's only you. Don't thank God yet, he said grimly, and switched on the kitchen light. Her vision swam in the flood of brightness, and she lifted a hand to her eyes to shade them. When she took her hand away, George was looking at her with a strange mixture of surprise and confusion, as if he'd expected someone else entirely. Under his gaze, she felt naked and intensely conscious of the fact that she hadn't set eyes on him since the morning after the night they'd made love for the final time. Reflexively, she pulled the robe more tightly around her. Edith, he said softly. She lifted her hand to ward him off, but he didn't move in her direction. He just stood. Turn off the light, she said, and please keep your voice low. Thomas sleeps in a chair in the downstairs bedroom where Sarah stays. We don't want to wake him, poor man, or Sarah. George turned off the light, and the two of them stood in the moon-drenched kitchen, waiting for their eyes to adjust, for the other to come into focus. What did you mean by that? Edith asked. By what? Don't thank God yet. In the moonlight, Edith watched his face go from soft to hard. John Blanchard is in police custody, he said. John? Said Edith. Light-headed, she pulled out a kitchen chair, almost toppling it over, and fell into it like a sack. For what? What else? Helping a murderess and kidnapper to escape. How? You were seen. The two of you. In your house, with Sarah. Edith raked her fingers into her hair and shut her eyes. Oh, no. You should have sent him away as soon as he showed up with her and the baby, George said coldly. Edith opened her eyes and stared at George Graham, trying to balance all the contradictory parts of this man who had spent money and years making women and children safe, and yet who could dismiss Sarah and Stephen as if they were nothing. Finally, she said, you never see their faces, do you?
What are you talking about?
Or hear their voices. You don't know the color of their hair, or how they jump at noises or flinch when they're touched. They aren't real to you. They aren't even stories, are they? They're what? Names on your list? Tally marks?
You're talking nonsense.
But your own story. You keep that one close, don't you? And all the characters in it are flesh and blood. George turned his face away. I'll bet you remember the color of that minister's hair. The one who sent your mother away when she came to him for help. Enough, he said, through tight lips. You didn't see Sarah, the shape she was in, and with a newborn baby? No one could have sent them away.
I take your point, Edith, said George, and still here we are. John caught like a rat in a trap. Your house compromised forever, useless to all those women who need help. And you and Sarah... He broke off.
Edith reached up and rubbed her temples, tried to clear her head. She said, They'll come after us, won't they? Sarah and Stephen and me.
They're already looking,
said George, and then asked sharply,
Did you tell Blanchard where you were going?
She nodded.
Good, he said.
She lifted her head. Good?
Yes. I don't know the man,
but he seems to be the noble type. I'm sure he'll do what he can to steer the authorities in all the wrong directions.
You're right, said Edith. John's not a liar by nature, but he will lie to help us. She imagined John, her friend, the most decent, innately kind person she knew, locked in a cage like an animal.
Good.
But I'll have to go home eventually, said Edith. George sat down at the table with her, and she watched him look at her, taking her in, his eyes growing distant and thoughtful. And then, after a few moments, something shifted, snapped into place, and Edith understood that she had just seen him make a decision.
If you go home, he said, you will be arrested and will almost certainly go to prison. At some point, you will be given a choice. Tell them Sarah's whereabouts and be granted some sort of leniency, or refuse to tell them, in which case... He shrugged.
That shrug made her want to slap him. How easy it would be to allow herself to hate him, to turn him, in her mind, from a man into a monster. But what good would that do? And anyway, it would be a lie. Edith thought of Sarah's husband. It was possible that there were monsters afoot in this world, but she knew that George Graham was not one of them.
Ordinarily, if you left now, you wouldn't know where Sarah and Stephen were because, before you'd even arrived at home, they would have been transported from here to their next place, said George. But moving Sarah in her condition is obviously impossible. She and Stephen will be here for weeks, maybe longer.
I would never tell them where she was, Edith said.
You'd be surprised at what you might do if you were facing a long prison sentence, he said. So going back wouldn't just be disastrous for you. It could put Sarah and Stephen in danger as well.
I wouldn't betray them.
He seemed not to have heard her. I'm sure John Blanchard will buy you some time. There's no need to leave right away, but you can't stay here forever. Neither can Sarah and Stephen. When the police realize they've been misled, they'll eventually start looking in the proper direction. You had to have stopped places on the way. People saw your car.
She remembered the gas station attendant, politely listening to her exhausted ramblings. She nodded.
Who knows? It's possible that they'll never trace you or Sarah to this house. It helps that you're in another country now. But they might find you, said George.
So what am I supposed to do?
Stay until you're ready and all the plans are in place. And then let me relocate you.
Edith fell back in her chair, stunned. You mean never go back?
I've done it for many women, as you know. And I'll be honest, fugitive life is hard. You will spend years looking over your shoulder. Some of the women, especially the ones with children, even regret their decision to leave, although so far, none have been desperate enough to go back.
She shook her head. But my life... My entire life is back in Antioch. I have nothing else anywhere else. No family, no real friends, no work. My clothes, my cameras, my boxes of important things. I've brought none of that with me here. Confused and frightened, she thought that if only she explained her situation as clearly as possible, he would see that she had to go back.
Edith, don't you understand that life as you've known it ended the moment you took Sarah and her baby into your house? Said George quietly.
John's life, too. How can I let him take responsibility for everything?
It can't be helped.
Edith heard a note of regret in his voice. You help him, she said. Whatever I do, wherever I end up, you help John however you can. Will you do that?
Yes, said George.
She nodded. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And what about my house? It's more than a house to me. It's Joseph. All that I have of Joseph.
George sighed. I can do whatever you want me to do about your house. Sell it or...
No! Said Edith, forgetting to whisper. She lowered her voice. Never.
As you wish. I'll do whatever you want.
Please don't speak as if I've decided. Edith's hands lay palms down on the table. George reached out as if to hold one of them, but then just set his own hand on the table between the two of hers.
Edith, you were wrong about me. Those women are real to me, all of them, even though most of them I never see.
Edith scanned his face and noticed, for the first time, how tired he looked.
I shouldn't have said that, she said. It was unfair.
You're real to me, said George quietly. I know the color of your hair, and I want you to have a life. Let me help you.
Edith sat still, struggling to absorb what was happening. But then she heard May moving around on the floor over their heads. At any moment, she might come down the stairs.
Think it over. Take your time, said George. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. And when you've decided, I will put it all in motion.
The full meaning of what they had been saying to each other hit her all at once, and the world seemed to spin. Edith had written down the names of the bruised and hollow-eyed and homeless, but who would make a record of her name and where she'd been? Who would catalog her injuries, document the tilt of her black brows, her laugh, her two hands cradling a coffee cup, or knotting back her wayward, wind-tangled hair? Nothing is decided, she reminded herself. Nothing. But when she closed her eyes and tried to hold on to her house, her canoes, her kitchen table, her boxes, her blue ceiling, Joseph's photographs, when she tried to reach her hands around all of it, it was as if every solid, holy thing she'd ever loved had turned to water and was already pouring through her fingers and rushing away, away, away.
Chapter 24. Claire. Compared to Edith's boxes, the box my mother held out to me was pretty drab. No golden swirl-grained oak or fragrant cedar or mahogany shiny as a mirror. No black lacquer tops or velvet linings. Just rubber-band-colored fireproof metal with a round lock on top, the key stuck inside it. But this had been my summer of finding truth in locked boxes, and this one just might be the last, so I took it from my mother's hands with the care and respect you'd offer any holy grail, any sanctuarium. I set it on the coffee table in my parents' living room, and all of us gathered around. My mother, Gordon, Cornelia, who was in town dropping off her children at her parents' house for a week of, as she put it, unfettered joy, limitless pie, and irreversible spoiling. Dev, whom I had picked up on the way down, and I. And slipping in at the last minute to look over my shoulder. Tall, slim, dark-eyed, handsome. Dead for more than 10 years, and invisible to everyone but me, was my father, Martin Grace. My parents had divorced when I was a toddler, and while my father was alive, until the day he left for London, where he died in a car accident, whenever I was with him, I was the one who felt invisible. He wasn't mean. On my rare visits with him, he joked and teased and bought me things. He called me Claro the Sparrow. He just didn't love me. And I knew it. And once he had died, I knew he never would. That could have been the end of our story, but then one day when I was 12 and won a writing award in school, I realized that even if he'd never loved me, I could love him. And that's when I began to edit him in. That night, when I stood on the stage in the school auditorium, receiving my award, I found an empty seat in the audience, near the back, but close enough for him to see my face. And I put him into it. Hello, I told him in my head. I'm glad you're here. Dances, Christmas dinners, my high school graduation. Even at my rehearsal dinner, he was there, a slender presence, half in shadow, stopping by just long enough to absorb the small allotment of love I beamed in his direction, and then disappearing like a trick of light. Now I told him silently, this is your box. And I'm glad you're here. And then I reached out and turned the key and lifted the lid. Photographs. Of course, photographs. Photographs, always. I almost laughed at how appropriate it was. One of Martin at 3 or 4 years old, sitting on his mother's lap. She's tiny and fair-haired and smiling directly into the camera lens, while my father's dark-haired father stands behind the two of them, his hand on his wife's shoulder, his face angled downward because he's looking at his son. Another photo of my father in a high school track uniform, kissing a trophy, his parents standing behind him, caught in mid-clap. Another of my parents on their wedding day, my mother swan-like and radiant in a narrow cream-colored suit with a portrait neckline, her hair in a French twist. My father cutting a Cary Grant-like figure, chin dimple and all, in his coat and tie. I handed the photos to my mother, who glanced through and handed them to Cornelia, who held up the wedding photo and said, "How did you two look like this? Wasn't it the late 80s? Where is the cotton candy hair? Where are the gargantuan square shoulders?" And my mother laughed.
"Keep going,"
said Dev to me. "I just really want it to be the same ring," I said. "And as long as that ring box I see in the bottom of this box stays closed, it might be the same ring. But if I get it out and open it, and it's not the same ring, then it definitely won't be."
"Remember when we were 15 and spent an entire day at the pool talking about Schrödinger's cat?
We were such nerds. How did we turn out to be so cool?"
Dev laughed. "Good question."
Then he nodded toward the box. I took out the black suede ring box, stared at it for a few seconds, then handed it to Dev. "You open it," I said. "I'm way too nervous." He grinned and handed it back.
"Not on your life. There might be a dead cat in there."
"This is no time to talk quantum physics," said Cornelia, shaking a finger at Dev.
"I was going to make a Pandora's box joke," said my mother, "but in the interest of time, I decided not to." "Claire,"
said Gordon gently,
"could you please open the damned box?"
I opened it. It was the ring from the photograph. Same flat square stone. In the photo, it had looked brown or black, but in real life, it was a shade or two darker than apricot jam. "Carnelian," whispered Cornelia. Same deeply carved gold sides, a shield on one side, a rampant lion on the other. Inside, still just barely legible, were the initials GLG. I slid the ring onto my forefinger, then reached into my shoulder bag and pulled Edith's photo from between the pages of the hardback book I'd brought to carry it in and keep it flat. I handed the photo to Dev, who held it up by its edge with his right thumb and forefinger. With his left hand, he reached out, scooped up my hand and lifted it, balanced on his palm, to his face. For a moment, I thought he was going to kiss it, but he just narrowed his eyes, looking. The tiny twinge of disappointment I felt at his not kissing it took me by surprise, but I forgot all about it, or mostly. A second later, when Dev said,
"It's the same ring, definitely. And with those initials inside, it couldn't be any other ring, could it?" "No,"
said Gordon, taking off his glasses and bending over to look.
"It's without a doubt the same ring."
"I can't believe it," I said. "Dev, it's the same ring!" Dev smiled, an event as sudden and breathtaking as a white heron breaking from the marsh grass to wing over water, brighter than snow. His fingers closed over mine and squeezed, and for a split second, all I knew was his face and his hand holding mine, and there was no ring and no photograph, and we were the only two people in the room.
"How cool is that?"
he said, and he let my hand go. I saw my mother and Cornelia exchange one of their 2-second, 1,000-word glances, and then Cornelia clasped her hands under her chin, eyes shining, and said, "Very." There was one more item in the box, neither hope nor a dead cat. It was a manila folder held shut with a paperclip. Inside the folder was one slip of paper, an adoption certificate. I didn't read further than the header before I stopped, reached over, took Dev by his t-shirt sleeve, and pulled. "Get over here," I said, and he walked around the corner of the table, and together we read. "Oh my God," I breathed.
"Holy shit,"
breathed Dev. "Gareth Grace," I murmured.
"GG,"
murmured Dev. "Tell us," barked my mother. We told them. On December 29th, 1956, in a Canadian town called Canterbury Mills, Gareth Lambert Grace and Louisa Cole Grace of Rye, New York, adopted a healthy baby boy, Caucasian, eyes brown, hair brown. In the spaces for the boy's place of birth, for his mother's name, and for his birth date, the same two words were typed. Unknown. Foundling. As I read, and for at least 20 seconds after I finished, no one moved or said a word. We all just stood around the table, swaddled in an awestruck hush. But after that one rapt moment, I got busy putting all the puzzle pieces together inside my head, and I could tell from the expression on Dev's face that he was doing the same thing. After about 10 seconds of this, our eyes met. "We should fill in the blanks," I said.
"Birthplace,"
said Dev. "Antioch Beach, Delaware," I said.
"Birth date?"
"December 3rd, 1956.
"Birth mother?"
My eyes filled with tears. "Sarah Giles." Dev smiled and bumped me with his shoulder.
"Go on. Sarah Giles. Who?"
I lifted my head and told my family. "Sarah Giles. My grandmother." We all moved into the family room, Cornelia having suggested that comfy chairs and sofas lent themselves to the task of processing revelation far more readily than did standing around a dining room table. As usual, she was right.
"Food would help too,"
said Gordon, and a few minutes later he was carrying in wooden carving boards covered with cheeses, smelly and not smelly, soft and hard, and prosciutto sliced so thinly you could see through it, baskets of cut-up baguettes, bowls of blueberries and strawberries and olives, and a big plate of molasses cookies he'd baked the day before. "I love you, Gordon," I said, popping a blueberry into my mouth. "With all my heart."
"I love you too,"
he answered, dropping a kiss on the top of my head.
"Now partake, people."
We didn't just partake. We gorged. We relished. We destroyed. Finally, my mother said,
"Claire, I don't know why I never gave you that box of your father's things before. I've been trying to decide whether or not I kept it from you on semi-purpose because of some kind of deeply buried resentment I harbored toward your father. And the answer I've come up with is that I honestly don't think so."
"No," I said. "That doesn't seem like something you'd do. Your resentment is never deeply buried. If it isn't buried in a very shallow grave, it's alive and well and walking among us."
"I thought exactly,"
said my mother.
"We just moved so soon after your father died, and there were so few personal items. Most everything was sold, the furniture, the apartment, the artwork. All the proceeds went into a trust with the rest of what he left you, the money you'll get when you're 25. Anyway, I forgot all about that box and that ring until I saw Edith's photo. I even forgot that Martin was adopted. His parents were dead when I met him, and he wasn't big on discussing personal information. He told most people that he was born and raised in Rye, New York, but now that I think back, he did mention the adoption to me once or twice, right after we got married. Anyway, I'm sorry about the box."
"That's okay," I said.
"It's lucky that I left the key sitting in the lock. Not particularly security-minded, but lucky. I'm sure I would never have been able to track it down."
"I'm pretty sure that if you couldn't find the key, Claire would have yanked that box to pieces with her bare hands,"
said Dev. "And teeth," I said. "So Gareth Grace, who you think called himself George Graham, was Mr. Big City?" said Cornelia. "Is that what we're thinking?"
"It all fits," I said. "He and Louisa are from New York, too, not far from the city."
"And Gareth worked in Manhattan," said my mother.
"Finance, banking, some money thing, I remember that now. Not sure about a Richmond connection, but we have a name, so it should be easy enough to track down."
"Oof, trying to put everything together in the right order is making my brain hurt," said Cornelia. "Can someone tell me in a slow, step-by-step manner how Sarah and her baby ended up in Canada?"
"Dev, you start," I said. "My brain's a little sore itself."
"Okay,"
said Dev.
"So, the night Sarah killed her husband, we'll assume things unfolded the way John described them at the trial. Sarah and Stephen weren't meant to be part of Gareth's escape system, but when John found Sarah distraught after shooting her husband, he took her to Edith's for medical treatment and so that she and the baby could be relocated. Then he drove her to the next safe house on the route, which must have been in this Canadian town, Canterbury Mills. Gareth probably didn't drive with him, but he must have met them there, either because that's how it always worked or because he already had the idea of adopting Stephen. We don't know what happened between him and Sarah, but I'm guessing that either she died of her injuries or she decided that her kid would be better off with Gareth and Louisa."
"I can see how that could have happened," I said. "Sarah was a fugitive. If she'd gotten caught eventually, who knows what would have happened to Stephen."
"But how hard," said my mother. "What a devastating choice that would have been for Sarah."
"All right, but I'm confused about something,"
said Gordon, scratching his head. It was a thing I loved about Gordon. He actually scratched his head when he got confused.
John Blanchard says he took Sarah away and was back at work the next morning, but there's no way he could have driven to Canada and back that fast. Maybe he put the two of them on a train or something,
said Dev.
Although Sarah was apparently really injured, probably in ways that would have attracted attention, and he knew the police would be looking for her, so public transportation wouldn't have been a great idea.
Or maybe, said Cornelia slowly, he didn't take her at all. He just told the police he did. Wouldn't Gareth have sent a car with an anonymous driver the way he usually did? And if that were the case, John wouldn't have mentioned it at the trial because he wasn't about to give away Gareth's relocation system.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that,
said Dev.
But you're right. Good,
said Gordon.
My second point of confusion is fuzzier.
Go for it, I said. We're on a roll.
Well, none of this is a coincidence, right? Edith was at the wedding.
Non-wedding, I said, automatically, and then grimaced. That's, what I call it, although usually just inside my own head. Gordon smiled.
Edith was at Claire's non-wedding on purpose. She probably read about it somewhere.
Oh, God, I said, covering my eyes. The stupid newspaper announcements. In more than one paper, too, with a photo and everything. I was mortified. Who announces an engagement? But Zack said it was a tradition in his family. Like the Barfields or the Kennedys, like anyone would care.
Well, someone did,
observed Dev. Oh, right, I said. Well, if those ridiculous announcements brought Edith into my life, I guess they were a good idea after all.
So here's my confusion. While I personally would give Claire a house or anything else under the sun that she wanted,
said Gordon,
why would Edith? Sarah was just a woman who seems to have spent a few hours at her house and then disappeared forever. Why would Edith give her granddaughter a house? Why would she even make a point of showing up at her wedding almost 60 years after she'd met Sarah?
I sliced off a piece of boucheron, popped it into my mouth, and contemplated Edith. Finally, slowly, I said, I think they belonged to her, all of the women and children she helped, at least a little. Not in an ownership way, but I think she felt responsible for them. That's why she kept the shadow ledger, to keep track, to help her remember them, even after they disappeared. I think it's how she was. Dev said,
but she couldn't literally keep track of them because they did disappear. She never knew where they went or who they became.
All except for Stephen. She knew that Gareth adopted him and took him back to New York. She knew that he became Martin Grace. She kept track of him because she could. And then she kept track of me. After a pause, Dev said,
you know, we promised we'd tell the Richmond people, Abby and Selby, if we ever found out more of the story. We should call them.
I met his eyes. We will. But why don't we wait?
For what?
Asked Dev. Until we get back from Canada. Chapter 25. Claire. About 2 hours into our road trip from the airport in Bangor, Maine to Canterbury Mills, as we were driving our tiny rental car through a tiny town full of tiny lakes, a dozen of them, like 12 dropped silver dollars, I realized that I was completely happy. And if the town seemed like something caught in the past, with its simple black-roofed houses and its single downtown street lined with storefronts, bakery, coin laundry, drugstore, shoe store, movie theater, coffee shop, a white church at one end, I was fully, mind, body, and soul, rooted in the now, as present in the present as I had ever been. Dev was driving, one tan hand on the wheel. We had the windows open. Dev's hair shifted around in the breeze. We had talked straight through the flight and through the rainy first hour and a half of the car ride, but the rain had stopped, and now we were sitting in a loose, amiable silence, surrounded by the crayon-bright, washed-clean world. Right then, what lay behind, all those mistakes I'd made, didn't matter. And what lay ahead, all those blanks we hoped to fill in, didn't matter either. The moment was complete. A brimming glass, a terrarium, and every question I'd ever had felt answered. I wish I could keep it, I said.
What?
This. Dev's profile didn't move a muscle, but a pink flush appeared in the center of his right cheek.
So keep it,
he said. When we got to Canterbury Mills, we parked the car on a side street and walked around, sticking to the neighborhoods and the little offshoot country roads because we figured that those were more likely places for a safe house than the downtown. I think I half expected a brass plaque nailed next to a front door or a historical marker stuck in the middle of a front lawn saying something like, "This house harbored Sarah Giles and her baby Stephen and a lot of other people. It was a good place." Of course, we came across exactly nothing like that, but somehow, just walking down those streets and seeing houses that could have been that house gave me something I hadn't known I was missing. "Maybe that's what I'm really searching for," I told Dev. "I mean, answers about whether she survived her injuries or where she went when she left here would be wonderful, but now that we're here, I realize that mostly what I want is for Sarah to feel real to me. Like those Civil War battlefield field trips we'd take as kids, and pretty much all you got was grass, rickrack fences, maybe a statue or two. But being there in that field, you could picture the battle. The smoke and shouting, the gunfire, and the boys dying on the ground. You could feel history prickling the skin up and down your arms." Dev stopped in the middle of the sidewalk and turned to face me. It had happened before over the years I'd known him. I'd say something, and Dev would regard me with a pure, almost clinical interest, as if I were a math problem or a scientific theory or a microscope slide or a zoo animal, which sounds off-putting and possibly creepy, I know, but somehow wasn't at all. In fact, I'd always liked it, being from time to time a thing that piqued his intellectual curiosity, sparked his neurons, got his wheels turning.
"Literal prickling?"
he asked. "Yes, like sleet hitting my skin and bouncing off, little stings."
"So do you feel Sarah here? Is she prickling up and down your arms?"
he asked. He looked down at my bare arms, and I lifted them, pale side up, elbow side down, for his inspection. "Yes. And Stephen, and Gareth, and Edith, too, even though she was never here," I said.
"That's interesting,"
he said. "It's not like ghosts," I said quickly. "More like an interplay between place and imagination and nerve endings, or something."
"Which could be like ghosts, I guess. What people think of as ghosts. I wish I could see what parts of your brain are lighting up when this happens."
"Whatever's happening, it helps me. The prickling. The unseen things become real. It solves something. Fills in a space. I don't mean it fills a hollow place inside me. It's more like those ovals on a standardized test. It shades in an answer to a question I hadn't known I needed an answer to," I said, and then laughed. "Yeah, that sounds weird." Dev shrugged.
"Good weird, though."
We kept walking, side by side, the noon sun resting on our shoulders and on the tops of our heads. "But hey," I said suddenly, "what if she was here?"
"Edith? You're thinking this because of the prickling?"
"More like the prickling got me thinking about how Edith might have been here. Remember how Gordon asked why Edith would leave me her house when she'd only been with Sarah and Stephen for a few hours, and I said that I thought she felt responsible for those two the way she did all the other Shadow Ledger people?"
"Sure, I remember."
"Well, that could be all it was, because I really do think Edith had this big, capacious Miss Clavell soul."
"Who's Miss Clavell?"
I waved his question off. "But what if it were more than that? What if, for some reason, Edith drove Sarah and the baby to Canada? And on the way, or after they got there, Sarah died. I don't want to believe that Sarah died, but it would help to explain why Edith felt so responsible for Stephen, why she would keep up with him for so many years. Edith is the one who gave Stephen to Gareth." Dev kept walking, lost in thought, his hands in his pockets, his eyes on the sidewalk in front of him. He nodded.
"That would explain why she disappeared from Antioch Beach around the same time Sarah and the baby did. She left with them."
"Right. And at some point while she was gone, she found out that the neighbor had seen her and John with Sarah and that John had been arrested," I said. "She knew that if she went back, she would be too."
"So she stayed gone,"
said Dev.
"Forever."
We walked on, side by side, our strides matching, our two shadows stretching down the sidewalk, preceding us, sometimes getting lost in the clutter of other shadows, trees, lampposts, but always emerging, clear-cut, and together. From time to time, our arms brushed each other, our shoulders bumped. Out of the blue, the thought came to me that I had first held Dev's hand when I was 13 years old, and that touching or not touching, together or miles and miles apart, I had never really let go. I said, Edith and I talked a lot about having a safe place, a home, carrying your safe place around with you like a turtle. I hoped that wherever she went, she brought Blue Sky House with her. Remembering something else Edith had said, I stole a glance at Dev. She also talked about people, I said.
She did?
She said the ones who look like home are home. They're where you go. After a while, Dev said,
Did she say you carry the people around with you too? Even when you're away from them?
I can't remember if she said it or if I just thought it.
Either way, I agree. That happens. I've done it.
He didn't look at me. Where did you carry them? I asked.
Her,
said Dev, correcting me.
And everywhere.
We checked at two churches and at the hospital at the other end of town to see if anyone knew if there had ever been an orphanage in Canterbury Mills, but no one had ever heard of one. The middle-aged woman working at the hospital front desk said that it was possible abandoned babies had been dropped off at the hospital in the 1950s, but the records from that long ago would be in storage somewhere, she didn't know where, if they still existed at all. It was when we were coming out of the Canterbury Diner, having sat at the lunch counter and devoured two pizza-slice-sized wedges of sour cherry pie, that Dev said,
Too bad there's not one of those public parks like in the movies where all the old-timers hang out and play checkers and reminisce, so that we could go ask them if they'd ever heard of a safe house for battered women or the story of a mystery man who came to town empty-handed and left carrying a baby.
I stopped short on the sidewalk in front of the diner, whacked Dev on the shoulder, and said, Bingo!
Okay, geez, or bingo,
said Dev, frowning at me and rubbing his shoulder.
Although people usually play bingo in fire halls or church basements or whatever, checkers is more of a park thing.
No, I mean bingo as in you're right.
You don't hit people who are right. You high-five them or shake their hand or hug them. You don't hit. But hell yeah, I'm right. What else would I be?
You have no idea what you're right about, do you?
Nope.
Old people, I said. We need them. A bunch of them, preferably. A critical mass.
A critical mass is the minimum amount of fissile material you need to start a nuclear reaction,
said Dev. The fact that you just said that out loud tells me once again that you did not get beaten up nearly enough in middle school. I seized him by the elbow and U-turned him back into the diner. Our tiny, adorable server, Audra, who had flirted shamelessly with Dev back when we were customers, although she could not have been older than 16, and who had the phrase, a murmuration of starlings, tattooed on the inside of her right wrist, stood behind the counter, reading a hardback biography of Harry S. Truman so thick that I wondered how her scrawny little bird-boned, bird-loving wrist could hold it. Excuse me, I said. Without even glancing up, Audra said,
It didn't stand for anything.
What didn't?
Asked Dev.
The S. That's why there's sometimes no period after it,
said Audra.
His middle name was just the letter S,
said Dev. She lifted her big, green, coal-rimmed eyes from the book, aimed them at Dev, raised her eyebrows, and said,
Indeed.
Then she smiled and batted, actually batted, her sooty lashes, and said,
Are you back for more pie?
Dev laughed. No, I said, giving him a stern look. We were actually wondering if there's a retirement community or maybe a nursing home around here.
Well, she's a fun date,
said Audra to Dev. Dev laughed again, and I elbowed him in the ribs. Audra sighed and swiveled just her eyes in my direction.
Yes, Greenbrier Community. My grandma lives there.
She gave us the address, and I typed it into my phone.
Thanks,
said Dev, and he shot her a grin that almost sliced his face in half.
Anytime.
Audra leaned a few inches closer to him.
At all.
As we walked out of the shop, I growled, Stop grinning like that. You look like a shark. And anyway, she can't see you anymore.
But you can.
Dev's grin got wider and sharkier.
Maybe we should stop by on our way out of town. Get a piece of pie for the road.
We found our critical mass of old people sitting out on the sunlit patio in front of the retirement community. Four of them sat in rocking chairs. One woman was on her knees planting pansies in a flower bed, and two of the men were actually playing checkers, which caused Dev to do a, thankfully abbreviated, victory dance, which I ignored. When the rocking chair people saw us, one of the women, she wore jeans and an Obama Hope t-shirt, stood up and said, "Come over here where we can see you." Dev and I obeyed. The woman assessed us, head cocked, hands on hips, then turned to her friends and said, "Do these belong to any of you?" The flowerbed woman squinted up at us.
"Not me. They're cute, though."
"I'm Dev, and this is Claire, and we're actually not from around here,"
said Dev.
"Well, of course you're not,"
said one of the checkers players irritably.
"We'd know you if you were."
The Obama woman gestured to a couple of empty chairs.
"Pull up a chair and stay a while."
We did. The gardening woman tugged off her gloves, slapped the soil from her knees, and pulled up a chair, too.
"I'm Tess," said the Obama woman. "These people are Maddie, Cleve, Paul, and Kate. The ones who can't be bothered to get up from their game are Jack and Pete. They're chronically grumpy."
"True fact,"
said Jack without turning around.
"So what's your story?"
said Kate, the gardener. Even though I'd given my spiel 3 times, at the hospital and both churches, here, with all those avid eyes on me, I was suddenly nervous. I cleared my throat. "So, I recently found out that my father, who died when I was 11 and who I didn't really know that well, was adopted. He grew up in New York, but he was adopted here."
"When was this?"
asked Tess. "December of 1956. I watched all those sharp eyes grow foggy and inward-looking for a moment, as all of them traveled back, or tried to travel back, over 50 years. When they seemed to have all returned, I went on."
"Was it a local girl in trouble?"
asked Kate. For a second, I didn't know what she meant, and then, starting just under her ribs, she drew a downward curve in the air with her hand and a universal symbol for pregnant. "Not local," I said. "We think she was, just passing through. Her name was Sarah Giles." They all exchanged looks, and then Tess shook her head.
"Doesn't ring a bell."
"We think she might have come with a friend, Edith Heron. And my grandfather, who came up from New York, the man who adopted Sarah's baby, his name was Gareth Grace, but people here might have known him as George Graham."
"An alias, what was he?"
called out Jack.
"A damn spy?"
I opened my mouth to answer, but Kate called back,
"None of our business, Jack Powell, so zip it."
No one remembered a man named either of those things, and no one knew anyone named Edith Heron. I looked at Dev, my heart sinking. Seeing my disappointment, Tess said,
"Names are the first thing to go. You'll find that out one day, but I can still place a face. Do you have a picture of any of these people?"
I reached into my bag and took out 2 photos. One Joseph had taken of Edith walking on the beach, and one of Sarah that I'd printed out from Antioch Library's digitized newspaper articles about the trial. Everyone passed the photos around. There was a lot of head shaking, and then, just as Tess was handing the photos back to me, Kate said,
"Let me see that printed out one again."
She held it at arm's length and narrowed her eyes.
"Well, this one looks a bit like Dr. Farley's daughter, Gwen. Pretty girl, similar eyes. But mostly it's that widow's peak. You don't see really defined widow's peaks like that very often."
Tess peered at the picture.
"Well, now that you mention it, that does look like Gwen," she said. "With that hairline that makes her face look like a Valentine."
A small thrill of hope ran through me. "Does Gwen still live around here?"
"No,"
said Kate.
"Moved to Boston years ago. Oh, I think it was Boston."
"Oh," I said.
"Comes up to visit every summer with her family, though," said Tess. "Or used to."
Her family. Dev's eyes met mine.
"Who do they visit?"
he asked.
"Well, old Dr. Farley, of course, Tom Farley, and his wife."
"They're still alive?" I said.
"Well, who the heck visits dead people?"
shouted Jack.
"Alive, last I heard, and I would have heard if they weren't, I think. Never knew Tom's wife very well. They lived pretty far out in the country, and she always kind of kept to herself, especially when her kids were growing up, had 5 or 6 of them. I guess they kept her busy because people hardly ever saw her for years. Got out and about a little more after they all moved away. Nice enough to talk to, but private, I guess," said Tess.
"Didn't want you poking your big nose in her business, I'll bet,"
said Jack.
"Can't say I blame her."
"Do you know her name?"
said Dev.
Tom Farley's wife?
Why, Sarah. Sarah Farley, said Tess. Her eyes widened. Well, I'll be damned. You don't suppose...
He was a doctor, I said to Dev. Like Edith was a nurse. A Dr. Fitz.
Do you know if Sarah came here from somewhere else?
Dev asked Tess.
Like maybe the United States?
Tess rubbed her chin, thinking.
I can't recall. Can you, Kate?
Well, I don't remember going to school with her or anything, but then she's quite a few years younger than we are.
Who isn't?
Said Jack. Tess slapped her forehead.
Chicago!
Really? I said. Are you sure?
Well, not positive, but I think so. Tom grew up here, but trained with a doctor in Chicago. I think Sarah was his sweetheart down there, and he brought her up one spring to marry her.
Oh, I said a little glumly. Spring doesn't fit.
Might not have been spring, said Tess soothingly. Although that's what I remember.
Your memory's as full of holes as a leaky boat,
bellowed Jack.
Hey,
said Dev, touching my wrist with one finger.
It's worth checking, right?
Go inside and get me some paper, Jack Powell, demanded Tess, and I'll write down directions to the Farley house.
Jack got up with a groan and shambled, mumbling all the way, toward the door of the building. Kate said,
And what about you two? Are you getting married?
She swished her forefinger back and forth between us. Dev smiled and rubbed the back of his neck.
Us? Actually.
Hey, I told Kate, cutting Dev off.
You never know.
Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Dev swipe a surprised glance at me.
Nope, said Kate, smiling. You never do.
It was a white farmhouse, deeper than it was wide, with black shutters, a front porch, and a single dormer window in the center of the gabled roof. The window reminded me instantly of the eye at the top of the pyramid on a dollar bill, which shows you how whirring and discombobulated my brain was. Don't be an idiot, I told myself. It looks nothing like that. But even so, as Dev and I sat in the car and looked at the house, I couldn't help feeling that it was looking back.
You ready?
Said Dev. I don't think so, I said. In my ears, my voice sounded like it was coming from the bottom of a well.
Oh. Well, that's okay. We can sit here for a while, or leave, or whatever you want.
No, I want to go knock on the door. I really do. I want to meet Sarah. It's just that my lungs seem to have stopped working, and my legs seem to have turned to wood, and I really don't see how, under these circumstances, I'm going to get out of this car, I said, my voice bouncing and echoing off the stone sides of the well.
Hey,
said Dev.
Claire.
I sat rigid, staring at the house.
Look at me,
said Dev. Okay, I said, but my neck couldn't remember for the life of it how to do that. Dev reached over, took my chin in his hand, and gently turned my head so that I faced him.
What are you afraid of?
Nothing, I'm not afraid. Dev waited. I sighed. I don't know. It just feels weird to have a grandmother. I never expected to have one. And she never expected me. What if she isn't happy to see me? What if I don't see any of myself in her? What if she sees me and remembers giving her baby away and gets upset? Dev moved his hand so that it was cupping the side of my face. But of their own accord, my eyes shifted sideways toward the house.
She'll be happy to see you,
said Dev. If I don't go in, if I just stay here in this car and then leave, she'll always stay the person who was glad I came. But if I get out and go up to that house, she might become someone else. Dev laughed.
Old Schrodinger again. There's a live cat in this box, Claire. I just know it.
The dormer window eye regarded me coolly. It gave nothing away. You do? I asked.
Yes.
Well, don't just sit there. Help me do this, I said.
Look at me.
With effort, I pulled my attention away from the house. There was Dev's face. His smooth brown skin and his hair falling on his forehead, and his eyes, dusky blue ridge blue.
And maybe because we were in a new place, or because my brain was swirling around like a murmuration of starlings, even though I had seen his face more times than anyone could count, it was new, too.
"Your eyelashes," I said, marveling. "They go all the way around, like a ruffle."
Dev smiled.
"Did you think maybe they'd stopped?"
I breathed in, and my lungs filled all the way up with air.
"You'll go with me?"
I said.
"Where else would I go?"
"Then I'm ready."
Halfway up the brick walkway, I took Dev's hand, or maybe he took mine, and we walked, our breath making clouds in the cold air. As I knocked on the door, I realized that I had no idea what I would say.
"Oh, no,"
I said. "What should I tell her? I haven't even..." But there she was, in a light blue sweater that matched her eyes. Sturdy, very wrinkled, her steel gray hair coming to a point at the top of her forehead like a valentine. Her eyes were light blue. Mine are dark brown. She was short and solid. I am tall and rangy. I searched for myself in her face, but didn't find me.
"Hello," she said uncertainly. "Can I help you?"
"My grandfather was a man named George Graham," I told her. For a moment, her expression went blank. Then she smiled, dimples appearing like magic in her cheeks.
"Oh, you,"
she said, tears making her eyes shine.
"You. Oh, after all these years, you beautiful girl. Come in, come in, come in."
She made us tea with honey. Holding the steaming mug in my hands and drinking the tea made me feel like a child with a sore throat who someone good was taking care of. We told her the story, tag-teaming it, beginning with my non-wedding, and Sarah sat with her shining eyes and didn't speak, except to murmur now and then,
"Oh, dear Edith, dear, dear Edith."
I finished up with Tess giving us directions to Sarah and Tom's house, and when I stopped, Sarah said,
"What a journey Edith sent you two off on."
Dev said sheepishly,
"Well, just Claire, really. She didn't know I'd be coming too."
"Hmm," sniffed Sarah. "I wouldn't be so sure. Edith was a person who knew things. Well, I suppose it's my turn now?"
"Yes, if you don't mind," I said.
"All right, then. I got sicker after Edith and George, or Gareth, rather, left."
Heartsick, I thought with a pang, because she had given her baby to Gareth.
"I had an infection that wouldn't go away, so I stayed here for weeks and weeks, suffered setback after setback. And then one day in mid-March, I woke up and realized that I would live. I was as weak as a newborn kitten, but I got out of bed and walked out into the living room, just inching along until I got to the nearest window. I stood there, hanging on to the window frame, shaky and fragile, but feeling alive from head to toe. And I saw crocuses opening up in the yard, yellow and purple. And for the first time, not just in weeks, but in years, it was as if spring were happening inside of me, too. I got better."
She smiled.
"And Tom and I fell in love. We didn't have far to fall, either. After all those weeks together, we were more than halfway there."
"So you stayed?" I said.
"He wanted to marry me right away, but I couldn't let him. By that time, we'd gotten word that John Blanchard's lawyer had turned him into a hero, the hero he truly was, in everyone's eyes. But part of me still waited every day for the knock at the door, for them to catch me and make me go back. And then one day in May, Tom said, 'Sarah, I think it's time to let go of that worry.' And the strangest thing is that as soon as he said it, I did let it go. Just like that. And Tom told everyone that his sweetheart from Chicago had come up to marry him, and right out there in the backyard of this house, we were married. When George left here for the last time on that night just before Christmas, he told Tom he wouldn't be sending people here anymore. I was the last. He said it was too risky. And maybe it was, but also, of course, he had the baby to think of. Babies change you. They change everything."
Here, Sarah stopped, and the tears in her eyes spilled down her cheeks, just one brief rush of weeping, before her face cleared, and she wiped the tears away. "Carefully, carefully," I said.
I can understand about the baby. A woman who worried that she might always be a fugitive, I can understand why she would have given her child to someone else to raise. Always looking over your shoulder would be hard enough without worrying that your baby boy might be caught too and given to strangers or worse. Gareth was rich and trustworthy, and he and his wife didn't have any biological children, so...